the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Until recently, Ethiopia has been hailed as an African success story. After a decade of strong economic growth, the country has begun to shed its image as a famine-struck wasteland. Africa's second most populous country has also been a strong Western ally in containing the militant group Al-Shabaab in nearby Somalia. But repression by Ethiopia's authoritarian government has sparked protests that have led to the deaths of hundreds of protesters this year. The movement gained worldwide attention at the Rio Olympics when the country's silver medal-winning marathon runner, Faisa Lilesa, crossed his wrists above his head at the finish line in a symbol of the protest movement. Now, since then, the situation in the country has only grown worse, with more than 2,000 placed under arrest in the past month and the government declaring a state of emergency. Diplomats and journalists have faced travel restrictions outside the capital, Addis Ababa, and the government has periodically cut access to the internet and even banned the crossed wrist sign given by Faisa Lilesa. Now, later in the show, we'll hear from a panel of experts, including a Bloomberg News correspondent on the ground in Addis Ababa. But first, a quick disclosure for all our listeners. I was previously a foreign correspondent in Ethiopia and have done advocacy for Eskinder Nega, a jailed journalist there. But with that, we'll go to our first guest, Sadali Lema. She's the editor of Addis Standard, a magazine which has been forced to stop printing in late October due to the state of emergency. Sadali, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, if you could, tell us, what is the genesis of these protests? Exactly who is protesting and why?
The genesis, the way I saw it, I divided into two. The first of the several protests that rocked Ethiopia for the last 1 year broke out in November 12, 2015. We're approaching the first year anniversary to that. It happened in a small town not far from the capital, Addis Ababa. The town is found in Oromia Regional State, which is the largest of the 9 regional states according to Ethiopia's federal arrangement. So these protesters, the protesters are led by the Oromo people, who are the largest ethnic group in Ethiopia, which in itself is home to 80 plus ethnic groups. The why is why I divided into two. The immediate cause of this protest is an opposition against what's now popularly known as the Addis Ababa Master Plan, and was developed by the federal government. Protesters were against it because this master plan is essentially an elaborated blueprint to expand the capital Addis Ababa into neighboring towns, which belong to the Oromia Regional State. So it would have, you know, the federal government would have done it so without due consultation with the Oromia Regional State, which is in charge of the region, and without due compensation to the Oromo farmers who would have been displaced from their land.
And so there is this ethnic dimension to the conflict. It sounds like you're placing the start of things about a year ago when the government tried to expand the city out into Oromia, displacing ethnic Oromo farmers. Tell us just a little bit about sort of the ethnic divisions in Ethiopia. My understanding is that part of what's driving the discontent is resentment against another ethnic group, the Tigrayan ethnic group, that's seen as being dominant in the government.
That's correct. That would lead me to the fundamental reason of this protest that was happening in the last 1 year, which is that the Oromo people, being the largest, or overwhelmingly the largest, I would say, majority in the country, they feel, you know, they believe, and in many cases it's true, that the fundamental question that has been simmering within them was the lack of genuine political representation, because, as you say, the political space is dominated by the minority TPLF, which hails from the north. The presence of widespread rights abuses within the Oromo nation itself, and pervasive economic marginalization, and all this. So these are the fundamental questions that have been simmering within the Oromo and also the other parts of the country's population, like the Amhara now, as we have seen it
lately.
Yeah,
tell us about the Amhara region, because we've seen that there have been protests by ethnic Oromos against the government. Now, another large group, ethnic Amharas, this past year, we've seen have also been taking to the streets, and there have been a number of people that have been killed and arrested in those regions as well. What are their grievances?
Their grievances are as well. The genesis to that dates back to 25 years ago today, when Ethiopia started to arrange itself in a federal settlement that it follows today. It dates back to grievances by the Amhara people against a land that they believe was taken from them and was incorporated into the Tigrayan regional state, which is home to the mighty TPLF. So the Amhara were also
the TPLF is sort of the core of the government's ruling party that's made up of ethnic Tigrayans, then, is that right?
Yes, it is. It's the core, and it's the most dominant as well, because these are the people who have fought for 17 years during the civil war of the Derg era. So that they believe by default, you know, gives them the right to dominate the political space there. So the Amhara people have been protesting about this arrangement, which took the land, part of a land, and incorporated it into the Tigrayan regional state, which is home to the TPLF within the ruling party in Ethiopia.
Well, tell us, if you would, about the media inside Ethiopia. What kind of a picture are people inside the country getting from television, from radio? Your magazine was just shut down.
Well, right now there's not much coming out, and there has not been much from the traditional media coming out over the last 1 year as well. I mean, there have been, of course, several attempts by journalists like William there in the panel, but most of the media consumption was coming through the social media, which was just controlled by the people who are protesting, you know, the people themselves.
So you couldn't turn on the radio and find out what was happening, or watch television inside Ethiopia and find out what was happening there?
Not much. It's if you hear about it, it's pretty distorted, because the media landscape in Ethiopia, I would say more than 90% of the media ownership landscape in Ethiopia is either owned by the government or institutions that are affiliated to the government. So when you hear about, if at all, about the ongoing protests, you hear them in a way, small people in some areas, some people in some places. So it's pretty, you know, quite the opposite of what was happening on the ground that we've been getting from the state-owned and affiliated media institutions on the ground.
And you mentioned the role of social media, even in these fairly remote places of Ethiopia, as being sort of a tool that protesters have used. What do we know about that? The government has been shutting off the internet in parts of the country.
Yes, the government, it's not the first time that the government is shutting down internet whenever they feel like things are going out of their control. The first thing they do is to shut down the internet. But what is true in Ethiopia is that, because even under the state ownership of the telecommunication, which is the sole provider of internet in the country, there have been fairly a large coverage of internet throughout the country, which enabled the young people who have nothing but a smartphone in their hands. So these young people are the ones that are on the social media today. So they don't want to wait for a government-controlled media to tell their stories. They are in charge of telling their stories using the social media. So that's been the trend. There were a lot of times when we, you know, were unable to go into protest areas, but just, you know, talk to or see people from the actual places or see their posters to understand what exactly was happening during the protests.
Sedali Lema, thanks so much for joining us on Global Journalist.
Thanks for having me.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week we're talking about the state of emergency in Ethiopia, where protests against authoritarian rule have triggered a government crackdown that has killed hundreds of people and heightened ethnic tensions. We're now joined by three other people who have been following the situation. In the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, is William Davison. He's the Bloomberg News correspondent in Ethiopia, and his writing has appeared in The Guardian and other news outlets. In Ottawa, Ontario, is Felix Horn, a senior researcher on the region for Human Rights Watch. And in San Jose, California, is Berhanu Langiso, an activist and former sociology lecturer at Ethiopia's Ambo University. Welcome to all of you. William Davison, let me start with you, because I understand that you were at one of the scenes, or nearby one of the scenes, of violence here last month. There was this harvest festival in a town called Bishoftu in the Oromia region, where dozens and dozens of people ended up dead. Tell us just a little bit about what happened there.
Yes, well, thank you for having me on the show, Jason. Yes, indeed, I was at the what's known as the Aricha Festival at Bishoftu at the beginning of October. It's the largest celebration for the Oromo people, who Tsidali just informed your listeners about. It's a very huge celebration. There's sort of up to 100,000 people or a few hundred thousand people who attend the event. The numbers are not known. And there was a very fervent protest that took place at the festival in front of a stage where there was some speeches due to be delivered by officials and traditional elders. That protest was ongoing when I arrived at the festival at sort of 7:30 a.m. on a Sunday morning and continued throughout the morning and got more intense. I think there was some discontent about who was on stage and that there was concerns that the event had been manipulated by the government. Obviously, the event was policed, and for most of the morning, the Oromia Regional Police tolerated this protest, which is in itself is quite unusual in Ethiopia. But the protest became more and more fervent, and it resulted in people approaching and clambering on the stage. One young man grabbed a microphone and very bravely shouted his rejection of the government, and that was wildly appreciated by the huge crowd. Anyway, the crowd clambered onto the stage, and at that point, the regional police responded. And then events get slightly unclear, but we know that tear gas was fired by the regional police to disperse the crowd. We heard other gunshots as well. Armored police units were sent out into the crowd, which immediately panicked and fled. And then in an absolute tragedy, what looks like tens or probably hundreds of people, maybe a figure of around 100, 150 fatalities, they sort of piled into a ditch and many of them were crushed to death. And this led to an outpouring of huge amounts of anger across Oromia region, including from in the diaspora online, and led to several days of destruction of property and protests across Oromia, which was met in turn by the state of emergency by the government just a week later.
Well, let me turn this to Berhanu Lengiso then, because we heard William talking about some of the ethnic tension that has been triggered in the country here over the past few months here. It seems strange to outsiders that a country would be divided into specific states on regional lines. It would be almost as if in the United States, instead of having Texas or Pennsylvania or Georgia, you'd have a land for African Americans and a land for Hispanics and a state for whites. Why is Ethiopia organized in this way? What sort of challenges does that pose?
Well, first of all, it is very important to make clear that Ethiopia has over 100 million population and close to 100 different ethnic and linguistic group. And the majority, the true majority ethnic group, the Oromo and the Amhara, make about 70%, close to 70% of the population. And there are many other small ethnic groups, especially in the southern part of the country. So from the history, these ethnic groups have been intermarried, intermingled, and they have been cross-cutted by their religion, even if there is ethnic differences. So the current government, the TPLF, basically used the divide-and-rule system to keep the two majority groups, the Amhara and the Oromo, apart, because the presence of these two groups, especially the solidarity between Amhara and the Oromo, put their legitimacy or called their legitimacy into question. The Tigrayan group or the group from where the TPLF, the ruling government, came, makes only 6% of the population. So this dividing the two group and pitting them against each other was the major tactic of the current government to rule over the country or to dominate the country. I want to make one correction on Will's comment that the attendances of the Irecha ceremony, the Irecha festival, has been in millions, between 2 to 4 million over the last 20, 15 years. It is not really enough.
Well, either way, it certainly sounds like it was an enormous festival here. And let me turn this to Felix Horn now, because even before these protests, it does seem that the political climate in Ethiopia was not very open. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Felix. In 2015, the government won every single seat in parliament. In 2010, it was something like 99%. So why haven't elections served as sort of a better outlet for popular discontent in Ethiopia?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I mean, one of the things that sort of led to the outpouring of anger and frustration that we saw after Arecha was that there's just very little space to express dissent, to have your opinions aired, and to have the government act on those opinions. I mean, as you said, there's very little in the way of independence in parliament, where the ruling party has 100% of the seats, not just in the federal parliament, but also in the regional parliaments. You know, when you combine that with the restrictions on independent media, independent civil society, there's very few ways to express these sort of very legitimate grievances, which is what triggered the protests that we've been seeing for the better part of a year now.
And what do we know about the situation for political prisoners inside the country? We talked about, I think there were 2,000 people arrested over the past month. How many people are behind bars now?
I mean, there's very little in the way of access for international human rights groups, so it's very hard to ascertain the exact numbers. I mean, we believe that tens of thousands were arrested up until June of this year, which is when we produced a major report. A number were released, but there's still a lot in detention. The numbers that have been detained under the state of emergency, it's really not clear. I mean, the only information that's coming out about that is the information that's coming from the government. I mean, I think in the weeks and months that follow, we'll have a better idea of the actual scale of detention, but it's very clear that there's mass arrests underway, particularly in Oromia and in Amhara region.
And I should say that we did invite representatives of the Ethiopian government, the Ethiopian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, to come on this show, and unfortunately they did not choose to accept our invitation. But William Davison, tell us just a little bit about what the environment is like for journalists in Ethiopia reporting on this state of emergency. You were at this festival. Is it easy to get access to information about these protests, about acts of violence?
I mean, generally not. The actual Arecha Festival itself was a bit of an exception because the government rather, I thought, complacently and naively facilitated access for the domestic and international media. So it was great to be there firsthand to witness events. Generally, reporting in Ethiopia can be very difficult. And when you get outside of the capital, Addis Ababa, and you're reporting on sensitive issues, whether politically sensitive issues or controversial economic stories, which involve displacement and large land investments, then the way that the system is set up here allows officials and members of the security forces to take arbitrary action against anybody, but particularly against journalists who they suspect of not being engaged in activity that is in their interests. So it becomes possible, it's easy to report in the capital. Normally, as Tadali said, there's a good internet connection. Now we have no internet, largely, so it's difficult to communicate with contact and always. And we expect, although the story is yet to be told, that during the state of emergency, the likelihood of arbitrary action, which prevents the work of journalists or indeed other members of civil society, opposition, politicians, is going to be further restricted during this period because, obviously the state of emergency acts to empower the security forces even further.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week we're talking about the state of emergency in Ethiopia, where the government has imposed a curfew and cut access to social media in an effort to quell popular protests. We're joined by William Davison of Bloomberg News, Felix Horn of Human Rights Watch, and Berhanu Lengiso, an Oromo activist. If you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read our interview with a former Bucknell University economics professor who is trying to raise a rebel army against the Ethiopian government from neighboring Eritrea. We're also on social media. You can subscribe to the video cast of our shows on YouTube, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at Global Journ. Berhanu Lengiso, I wanted to turn things to you now. One of the aspects of these protests has been that the protesters have turned against a number of sort of foreign investments, foreign companies inside Ethiopia. I believe there was a juice factory that was burned, as well as a number of tourist lodges. Why are foreign investors being targeted?
Well, that's a very important question. The protesters targeted the foreign investment because the economic rise narrative is the single most important narrative for TPLF. The TPLF has used this narrative to make dictatorship acceptable at global level. So the rising economy narrative is basically a false narrative because it is mainly based on cooked data. I do not mean there is no growth, there is growth in the country, but this growth has been dominated by foreign investment and the government businesses. The government has been using this narrative to, you know, sell itself to the West, to act, you know, as a democratic government that is doing well economically in the country, to get its, you know, support from the Western government. The population or the Ethiopian people knows this very well, and when they continue to use little force against them for almost close to 1 year. They started to target the base of their legitimacy, foreign investment and the government businesses. That also touched the nerve of the ruling party. That is basically why they declared the state of emergency.
Well, I think you raise a good point here, Berhanu, and let me turn this back to William, because I think you had something to add to that.
Yes, I did. And I mean, and this is a more of a sort of a general, you know, how we approach this subject. Personally, I think it's, you know, very important to get away from binary narratives here. There's very little I disagree with in what Sadali said in her introduction about the lack of democracy in Ethiopia and the ethnic political problems, and a lot of what I agree with what Berhanu has said. But the fact of the matter is that Ethiopia, under the TPLF, which, yes, is the dominant power within the government, has very deliberately constructed an authoritarian development model of the type that we've seen, particularly with China and other East Asian states. Now, the reason I make this point is that, yes, there are some large doubts about the GDP statistics that are pumped out by the government. But along with that, there has also been significant economic growth in Ethiopia. This, of course, doesn't erase or mean that the political problems are insignificant. But when we're trying to understand Ethiopia's current predicament, it is a country which has been significantly growing. Of course, that growth could be spread more equitably amongst the population, amongst different ethnicities. But it is a government that has made significant achievements during its time in power, as well as having done nothing to solve Ethiopia's longstanding political problems and arguably exacerbated some of the ethnic tensions that exist.
Let me turn this to Felix Horn then, because it seems that Berhanu and William both agree that Ethiopia has been following sort of the Chinese model of development in that it has focused on economic development, foreign investment, generating manufacturing jobs, while at the same time not opening its political system. Are we seeing something of the limits of that model here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair assessment. I mean, you know, for years we've interviewed people that didn't sort of bear the fruits of this economic model. You individuals that were displaced from their land, or who tried to complain to the government about different aspects of the development, and they were targeted as a result. So there's always this sort of simmering tension, and the idea that just, you know, a single narrative did get out about Ethiopia's economic growth. And, you know, the other thing to point out to me is that Ethiopia is a very young population that is increasingly educated, and they're demanding different things to what their predecessors did. You know, so we've interviewed several hundred protesters since these protests began, and when we talk about sort of how they view this economic boom, I mean, they acknowledge that there has been improvements. They acknowledge that there is opportunities, but they don't see that they're benefiting from that, those economic opportunities. Those opportunities are in their view, reserved for those that are more closely affiliated with the government. So that yes, clearly has limits. And I think it was very noticeable to us in the early months of the protests that the foreign businesses were not targeted. You know, the protests were predominantly peaceful. But following Arecha, you know, that frustration just boiled over, somewhat predictably. resulting in the targeting of businesses. And that's when the government began to panic and declared the state of emergency, which is only, in our view, is only going to further exacerbate the tensions.
And Burhanu Langisu, are there any indications that the government is willing to compromise, to give ground? And even if the government is prepared to negotiate with the protesters, is there any sort of broad-based opposition for them to negotiate with?
Well, I think the protesters are beyond that. They have one and only one question now, and that is regime change. The government is now ready to listen to people. They are now ready to accept this major question. What they are coming out with is now, you know, this cosmetic change, like reshuffling the cabinet at regional and the federal level. And they are not really into their sense. They are not listening to the people for the last one year. So I think the country is basically exploding. The country is in a very serious crisis. If the government is now willing to listen to the people and willing to, you know, arrange transitional processes to return the power or pass the power to the people, the country will be in a very, very serious problem.
Well, let me turn this back to you, William Davis, and our time does grow short. We did see that the Ethiopian Prime Minister, Haile Mariam Desalegn, reshuffled his cabinet, brought in, I think, 11 new ministers just a couple days ago. What do you see happening over the next couple years here? How will this situation evolve?
I'm afraid all I really see is a deteriorating economic situation, a stagnating political situation, and increasing security focus of the government. You know, I think the point that I raised about the economy is kind of significant, because this is a government which has more resources than it used to. It's also a government that very much believes in its own model. Now, the government has been rocked significantly by these protests, but we know from the quarter of a century that the government has been in power that it has no real interest in political or economic pluralism within Ethiopia. It's a party which wants to develop Ethiopia according to its own ideology, and it's not going to be knocked off that course even by protests this serious. So I think what we're going to see is a further crackdown, and unless there's some significant reorganization and rethinking of the strategy from protesters, then we will just see occasional flare-ups and the protests getting quashed by the government.
That's going to have to do it. I'm sorry, Will, we're out of time. We're going to leave it there for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Missouri School of Journalism and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Many thanks to Tzedali Lema, William Davison, Burhanu Langisu, and Felix Horn for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Eloise Spilliers, Bryce Arthur, and Mengchen Zin. Our supervising producer is Vera Tan, with visuals editor Anadil Iftikhar. Pat Akers of KBIA is our audio engineer. Travis McMillan of RJI is our director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.